is next.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Ever since the days when reporters wore a soldier's uniform and reported on our brave boys in battle, relations between journalists and the military have been strained. After Vietnam, the Pentagon brass decided they needed to do things differently or risk more news like this.
Sniper fire is still coming from some buildings around the American officers' quarters.
What's the hardest part of it?
Not knowing where they are, that's the worst.
You lost any friends?
Quite a few. We lost one the other day. The whole thing stinks.
General, how would you assess the enemy's purposes yesterday and today?
The enemy has taken advantage of the Tet Truce in order to create maximum consternation.
That was, by the way, the voice of General William Westmoreland. Well, by the time the soldiers suited up for Desert Storm in 1991, relations were at an all-time low. Reporters were asked to make do with Pentagon pool pictures and interminable briefings by another general, Norman Schwarzkopf.
I apologize for the busy nature of this chart, but I think it's very important for you to understand exactly what our strategy was. What you see here is a color coding where green is a go sign or a good sign as far as our forces are concerned. Yellow would be a caution sign, and red would be a stop sign.
And in preparation for what increasingly seems like the next Gulf War, the Pentagon and news editors have come up with a new plan. They're placing reporters and photographers with the troops. Embedding them is the word they use. Embedding them with various units. Connection listeners, reporters are always looking for better access to news stories. Do you think having journalists travel with the troops will bring you better coverage? Or when it comes to war reporting, can familiarity compromise objectivity? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this hour is Charles Lewis. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Hearst newspaper chain. That includes daily newspapers in places like Seattle and Houston, Albany and San Francisco. And we'll be talking with some other reporters later in the program. We're also joined today by the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Media Operations. Brian Whitman is joining us from the Pentagon. Both of you, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder, Charles, if I can start with you, because you were a part of the coverage team in 1991. In fact, I read something that you wrote shortly afterwards in which you described it as one of the most bizarre episodes in the history of the press and the military. How bad was it?
Well, you know, Dick, I think that we start with Grenada in 1983 as sort of the low, low point of media-military relations, because there, the media was not even allowed on the island. And then you go forward through different military operations to Desert Storm. And Desert Storm was a little bit better than Grenada. At least we were on the island, if you want to call Saudi Arabia an island. But restrictions in Desert Storm were very severe. First of all, the military retained the power of assigning stories to be covered. And if you wanted to cover a story in the pool system, a Army colonel had the authority to say, well, no, we don't want to do that story, or yes, we'll do that story. We'll give it to the pool tomorrow, and the pool would go out and cover the story, and it was your idea to begin with, but you didn't get to go out, and instead you got to copy the pool report or raid the pool report when it was finally written by the pool that was assigned to cover the particular idea that you came up with. Then the military also had blue pencil editing power, which is to say they would exercise censorship over the copy before it was transmitted, or over the photos or the videotape before it was transmitted. And because it was transmitted over military lines, they controlled when it was going to be transmitted. So we've got a long way to go to improve on that, but it should be pretty easy to improve on. because that was pretty bad.
It was made worse, was it not, by a chain of command where you as journalists in Tehran would say to someone who was supposed to help you, can we do this? And the officer would say, well, I think it's a really good idea, Charles, but, you know, the folks in Washington aren't going to let you do that. So nobody was really taking responsibility at that time, were they?
Dick, you know, you put your finger on a very subtle but very crucial power that was exercised by the military over the media in Desert Storm, and that was the power to decide what got covered. And, you know, people think of censorship as blue pencil editing, yes, no, or you can't say it this way or whatever. In Desert Storm, the mere issue of what was going to be covered was a decision that the military made, and that's a very subtle but crucial power that the military had. And I think that we're past that now, I hope. And I think we're looking forward, looking ahead anyway, to a new and better relationship. You know, there's a built-in tension, though, between the media and the military. There always will be. The question is, will intelligent, reasonable people be able to work out that tension on a day-to-day basis? And right now, I think the media in Washington who have been working with the Pentagon on the new plans, we're hopeful that the picture is going to be better if there is a military action in Iraq.
Brian Whitman, at the Pentagon, you inherited this legacy of frustration from 1991. This policy of embedding that you've come up with and agreed on with news editors, do you see it as something that's designed to answer those frustrations?
Well, I guess I'd have a couple comments on that. First of all, I don't think that probably any system that we might come up with will completely satisfy everyone. There is a tension, and I would tell you it's probably a healthy tension between the military and the media at times. And it stems out of our need to balance the access and the information that we provide to the media with protecting that type of information that's going to make sure that our operations are successful, and that those that are carrying out those operations aren't put in harm's way by the type of information that we provide. Having said that, I do believe that the Pentagon is a growing, learning institution, and we are always looking for better ways in which to work with the media so that they can accomplish their goal and their mission of providing information to the American public, as well as allowing the military to accomplish their mission, their very important mission, too. So I think that embedding offers a lot of opportunities to close that gap, and we here in Washington have been working very closely with the editors and bureau chiefs and individual reporters, and I think that this is something that they see as a positive development as well as we do.
Brian, tell me how it would work. If I was embedded with a unit in southern Iraq, for example, and the unit was moving forward and making certain plans or engaging combatants somewhere, who makes the rules, who makes the decisions about what I get to file as a reporter?
Sure. We have established an overarching guidelines, ground rules, if you will, on what can be covered and what can't be covered, or when something can be covered. But these are broad general guidelines. The fact of the matter is these things are going to have to be decided between experienced, mature reporters and commanders on the ground. And I don't think that, you know, I have never met a reporter, and there may be one out there, and I just haven't met him, but I've never met a reporter that intentionally wanted to compromise the U.S. military mission. Just haven't met that person yet. And I think it's hard to believe that there would be a reporter that would be with a unit that would want to compromise the success of that unit that he's traveling with.
Charles Lewis, when I read about this, I'm hearing from television correspondents speculating about doing live coverage of battles, and at the other end of the extreme, a near total blackout for reasons that Brian's explained about wanting to control access and information. How do you think it's going to work?
Well, Dick, first of all, I want to compliment Brian Whitman and his colleagues at the Pentagon on working with us to try to make this a better relationship. And the test, though, is going to be in the future how it works and how it's applied in the field. And I think that's what you're leading into, Dick, and that is where do we go from here? And I think that we can spend a lot of time in Washington designing the perfect theory of news media coverage of a military operation. We can spend hours across the table from each other designing the language. But unless and until it's implemented in the field by commanders in the field who are sensitive to the very values that we're talking about today, until that happens, all this planning in Washington doesn't amount to a hoot. And I think the test will be how it's put into effect. You know, I was embedded, if you want to use that word, with the 2nd Infantry, 2nd Armored Division in Desert Storm. And I was part of the left hook that moved through Iraq into northern Kuwait over to the Highway of Death. And I traveled with the 2nd Armored Division. It was a Germany-based division. And I had really crummy access. I had no access to the brigade commander. My handler at the time was an Army Major Roger King, who is now the chief spokesman for the United States military in Bagram, Afghanistan, and now a full colonel. I was kept back from the action. There was a terrible friendly fire episode in the course of that 100-hour ground war that affected my unit. And they
Charles,
lied to
Charles,
me.
What will be different this time around? If we look ahead to the type of embedding that we're talking about, why might it be different? How could it be different?
You know, Dick, we don't know if it's going to be different. We hope it's going to be different. And the values that Brian Whitman and his colleagues have conveyed to us are much more open and much more have indicated much greater access to the forces that we will be embedded with. It is still possible for me to imagine that that same kind of restrictive confinement that I incurred during Desert Storm could also apply in any future operation in Iraq. I think it goes to the point that I'm making, and that is how these principles, how these policies and values are applied on the ground in the future. That is the big question, and I think we'll just have to wait and see how it goes.
Okay.
But we are hopeful. We are hopeful at what we see and what we hear from Brian Whitman and his colleagues.
Brian, just briefly, what is it that the commanders on the ground have been told about working with the reporters? I gather there's some 500 reporters and crews who will be embedded. What have the commanding officers on the ground been told?
Sure. I think there's a couple of things I'd like to say. I think Charles is absolutely right. At the end of the day, we'll be evaluated in terms of how well this embedding is actually executed. And I do believe, though, that we have enlightened commanders out there. I think that today's military understands the role and the importance of the press. And I have to tell you that their instructions have come from the highest levels of this department. This aggressive embed plan would not be possible without the strong support of Secretary Rumsfeld and Chairman Myers and Tommy Franks, the central commander.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after the break, a chance to talk with a couple of experienced war correspondents who've been listening in so far, their thoughts on embedding. We'd also like to hear from you as to whether or not you think this type of coverage is going to make the news that you get from a war any better than what you've got in years past. Is this something that just reporters whine about, or does it matter a lot to the people who are listening to the radio as well? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 for you to join us. We're now joined by two reporters, In our conversation about the changes in the Pentagon policy for war coverage that could make a dramatic difference or only a small difference in the type of news that we see from a war in Iraq, assuming that war takes place. We're joined by Eric Westerveld. He's a correspondent for National Public Radio. He's covered a range of defense and foreign policy issues abroad and at home. Eric is currently in Kuwait and later this week will be embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. Chris Hedges is a New York Times reporter. He has covered he covered the Persian Gulf War with the New York Times as a non-pooled reporter. He's the author of a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and Connection listeners may remember that conversation we had with Chris about the book. Eric and Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Eric, let me start with you. You asked to be embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry, or you asked to be embedded. What was your thinking there? What are you looking for?
Well, I cover military affairs and work out of the Pentagon, cover military issues, and I wanted to get a chance to talk to the grunts and the soldiers in the front lines as best I could. And my experience in Afghanistan and elsewhere was that the access to those frontline troops was extremely limited, and when I heard that the Pentagon was going to experiment with this embedding system, I wanted to try that. I will say that, you know, we're going to have a veteran correspondent, Mike Schuster, who will not be embedded, and he'll be on the ground here in Kuwait doing what he can, the best he can, to follow the troops and do stories out of Iraq if there is a war, but myself and John Burnett will be embedded. I'll be with the Army's 3rd Infantry, and John Burnett is with the Marines. I just thought it was an opportunity, and I will see how it plays out, to see the soldiers in action and be close to them.
Now, you've been in the Gulf over 2 months now. Have you had a chance to spend some time with the people that you'll be embedded with?
Yeah, I've been in the Gulf most of the last 3 months and covering the buildup and the reaction in the Gulf region. And I've done several short-term embeds, as they're calling them, with U.S. forces that are gathering here. Some were 5-day, 2-day, 1-day trips out with the Army and Marines. And I have to say it's been pretty refreshing to have largely unrestricted access to the soldiers, to be able to talk one-on-one with them, you know, without a military escort hovering over my shoulder. Like there was, you know, I'm told during the pool system of the Gulf War, in both many of the cases, you know, a public affairs officer would drop me off with a specific unit, and then you're with them for the duration. You sleep on the ground or back of a Humvee, as the soldiers and Marines do. You're traveling, eating, living with these service members. And as a journalist, I found it pretty positive because you got a one-on-one chance with these soldiers. Clearly, during combat operations, there will be more control over the embedded journalists. And, you know, I think it's a trade-off, or giving up some of our independence in order to get greater access to the battlefield and to the troops. But I'm cautiously optimistic that you know, those restrictions will be reasonable and we'll be allowed to do our jobs.
Stay with me, Eric. I want to bring Chris Hedges in. Chris has over 20 years work as a foreign correspondent, Central America, Middle East, Asia, and Africa. And Chris, like Charles, you went to the first Gulf War in 1991 and decided at that point to avoid the pool system. In fact, you've been avoiding pool systems most of your reporting life. What's your problem with them?
Well, the big problem is they control where you go and what you cover. If you depend on the Army for transportation and logistics, you're captive. Now, I'm not opposed to embedding. I mean, I think that journalists should be embedded. But as we saw in Afghanistan, those reporters that get out and report stories that the Pentagon do not want reported, and I'm thinking of Doug Strzok, the Washington Post reporter, when he tried to visit the site of a U.S. Special Forces raid in Kandahar that took place on January 24th of last year, soldiers not only turned him away at gunpoint, but warned him that if he went any further, he would be shot. Of course, back in the Pentagon, Rear Admiral Craig Quigley, said that Strzok's version was completely inaccurate and this kind of stuff. But that's common. I mean, I think in the first Persian Gulf War, of when the Iraqis invaded the border town of Hafji and they were giving press conferences in Dahran and Riyadh talking about the Saudis defending their homeland. In fact, the Saudis fled the moment the Iraqis massed at the edge of town and they were pushed back by the Marines.
or I think of the images that were fed to the broadcast media of Sidewinder missiles, Patriots knocking down Scuds, precision-guided missiles going down chimneys. That was all, in essence, not a lie. It was the lie of omission, which is usually the lie of wartime, because 90-something percent of the ordnance dropped on southern Iraq were dropped from Vietnam War era B-52 bombers. And it was, indiscriminate iron fragmentation bombs that blew away southern Iraq. I was in southern Iraq after the war with the Shiites, and eventually was captured by the Iraqi Republican Guard. I guess I was embedded in an Iraqi Republican Guard unit. So got a good view of what we did to the South, and that juxtaposed with the image that was presented by the Pentagon and disseminated by the media was completely false. And that will be no difference in this war. It is those independent journalists like Doug who try and get out there and try and get a story who are going to be ruthlessly stomped upon. You can be damn sure that any time things go wrong, we spoke earlier about the friendly fire, that kind of stuff, you're not going to be driven up to see that. You're not going to be driven anywhere near it. There's that great quote from Senator Hiram Walker, 1917, in war, the first casualty is truth. They have a battle to win, and they will use the press as part of that battle. Look back at Rumsfeld and others, and these are not people who have in the past expressed a particularly high opinion of the mainstream media. So I'm very pessimistic.
But just to be clear, you're saying that embedding is something that can be a useful part of the coverage.
Oh, I think you have to be embedded. But you also have to, news organizations also have to have reporters and camera crews that are not embedded, that are outside the system,
right,
and that try, for instance, to go back, as reporters did in Afghanistan, to look at the bombing of Afghanistan and assess the civilian casualties. What I see, and that's usually only about 10% of the press that wants to do that. Most of the press doesn't have the stomach for it. And the reporters that be embedded are not going to be in the first wave. And I think, as we saw from the first Persian Gulf War, may be kept pretty far back until the military cooks up whatever version they want and then disseminates it. And what I worry is that this administration has shown a deep reluctance to permit the kind of independent reporting that is absolutely essential in wartime if we're going to be told the truth. And look at the images, the way they disseminate, the way they work with the press. There's no more candor now than there was in Vietnam. What they've perfected is the appearance of candor.
Let's hear from Charles Lewis here, because, Charles, you've got a great number of reporters on various different strings, and you're listening to Chris's description of the situation. Do you disagree with him?
No, I agree totally with him. I think embedding is the start of the process. It's certainly not the end of the process. And people who are in the theater, in the region, who are not embedded, will have a crucial role also in covering any conflict. They'll also serve as a true audit of just how honest the embedding process is. If what we called unilaterals, Chris was a unilateral in Desert Storm, and Chris, those of us who were captive of the pool system applauded you for your independence. The unilaterals will serve as a kind of an audit to just see how honest the embedded journalism is and what kind of access is being granted to the embedded correspondents and camera crews.
Brian Whitman, let me hear from you, because we're hearing from Chris a deep skepticism about a change in heart here.
Well, sure. And like I said, anybody is entitled to be skeptical, I suppose. But, we're often accused in the military of fighting the last conflict or preparing for the last conflict. And I see a lot of that in the way Chris is trying to describe what we're doing. The fact of the matter is that reporters will be in what he calls the first wave. Reporters are currently embedding in frontline units at the company, platoon, battalion level. An embedded reporter is going to see both the good, the bad, and the ugly. What an embedded reporter is going to see from what I would call the good is he's going to see the professionalism and the dedication, the how well trained, equipped, and led our forces are, how careful they are as they prosecute war. they're going to see the bad because soldiers, sailors, Marines are human and they make mistakes, and they're going to see those mistakes. And I don't believe that that they will not report on those mistakes, as Chris might have suggested. And they're going to see the ugly. They're going to see that war is ugly, and they're going to see it from right up front how ugly war is. And it's important, I think, that they do.
Eric Westervelt with NPR, you've had some experience working with your people in the 3rd Infantry. I'm just wondering whether or not you can tell us what's sort of struck you as something that you might not have known, might not have expected, that you think will change or color your reporting, add to NPR's picture?
Well, I'd say during the training sessions, and obviously the training's gonna, the combat's going to be a lot different, I was turned loose and given free range there to meet and talk with soldiers. I was able to ride in the XO's Humvee and listen to the radio crosstalk, to hear the commander when he got pissed off because someone wasn't doing something right, to see when, you know, young soldiers and bulldozers were practicing going over a berm and, you know, they weren't doing it right and was holding everyone up and messing things up. And, you know, it wasn't hid from me, and I'm hoping and I'm cautiously optimistic that during combat, and I will say, you know, from what I've been told by commanders on the ground here that I'll be embedding with, we will not be kept in the back in some supply line. Some of us will be up front. And I'm hoping that that kind of access will continue. There hasn't been an effort so far,
right,
at least training short-term embeds, to hide things from it.
My only question about that, Eric, is once the war begins, assuming it does, will you be able to file those stories? I mean, one thing to see what you see, are you going to be able to tell those stories?
You mean given the restrictions or what?
Yeah, will you be able to do daily news filing saying, this is what I saw yesterday, this is what we're doing today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that I will be able to do those stories. There are some restrictions. We haven't been given the final version of any ground rules. There will be some restrictions, I'm told, about going live in terms of telling us specific locations and exact troop strength. And I think, you know, in some cases that's a legitimate concern. That information, if broadcast live, could endanger soldiers and journalists' lives. But my sense otherwise is we will be able to tell those stories, hopefully freely.
All right, Chris Hedges, just a final comment from you. Are you going to be covering this particular war?
No, after 9/11 I switched. I was covering Al-Qaeda cells in Europe and doing intelligence coverage. I'm not going back into a war. I've done it for 20 years, and it's dangerous work. I just want to say, Brian, that, you know, I mean, I think the points raised ignore the fact that once you get into a battlefield situation, you can't really see anything. If you're stuck in the back of an Amtrak, you know, you'll hear a lot of noise and feel a lot of jostling. If you're in a corner of a battlefield, even as a soldier, you just don't, you barely know what's going on around, just around you. And the notion that reporters will somehow get some kind of bird's eye view, especially in the midst of combat, which is, or even near the front lines, I think is dubious. I mean, I still think the military, as it does in every war, is going to cook up their version of events and use the press to disseminate it. And remember that when they did the studies, the Army did their own studies after the war, they concluded that the restrictions were just so severe that they fail to get their own message out. And
Chris,
what this is about.
I'm going to move on. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Chris Hedges, New York Times reporter, and Eric Westervelt, thanks for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
Eric's a correspondent with National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Woburn, Massachusetts now, and Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment, and that was that I think it's a no-brainer to embed journalists in this war. My most memorable reading on the Vietnam War and how it played out was from a book called Dispatches by Michael Kerr, where he was embedded.
Michael Herr, I think it is. I know the book well.
Okay. And he was embedded with a long-range reconnaissance patrol, and I just seen it really conveyed the essence of what was happening on the ground with that reporter's book.
And based on the description of what you're hearing, Paul, do you think that we will be closer to that type of reportage with reporters embedded with the various units in Iraq?
Yeah, I would hope so. I'm less concerned about the live daily reporting more than the archives with which some of these reporters can pull off to create books like Michael Herr's later on.
And Charles Lewis, I mean, that's actually one of the things that I was wondering as well, whether or not the embedding that we're talking about isn't something that's better tailored towards a magazine reporter who gets to gather all her material over a period of time and then tell the story, rather than the frustration of saying, as a daily news reporter might have to do with the commanding officer, can I say this? Can I say this? Can I file this?
Dick, I think you're exactly right. The embedded reporter is going to be the feature writer, is going to be the long-term writer, is going to capture the particular profile or whatever, is not going to give a bird's-eye view, to use Chris Hedges' concept. The bird's-eye view will come from a higher level of command. It may come from the Pentagon. It may come from a briefing center in Qatar. But the people who are embedded will be doing feature stories. They will be doing what it is like to be a soldier with the 3rd Infantry Division moving into Iraq, what it's like to live in the desert, what it's like to sustain yourself in this hostile environment, that kind of stuff. And you're not going to get big picture battle stories from embedded reporters. Just not going to happen.
Brian, Eric just said before he left that there were still some bits of information or details about how the whole system's going to work yet to come out. What's missing? What's yet to be worked out?
Well, right now you have reporters that are just beginning their embeds in theater, and they will be given a full list of guidelines, and they'll be tailored off of the broad ones that we've provided to the field. But every unit may have a unique situation given where it may be located or given what its mission may be. And some of those pieces of information are going to have to be protected or protected until a point in time when it won't compromise the success of that operation.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Charles Lewis is with us. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Hearst Newspaper Change. Brian Whitman is Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Media Operations. And we're taking your calls on plans for a change in war coverage when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Pimsleur Direct Language Programs, featuring over 35 different languages, including American.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Talking about press coverage of a war anticipated for Iraq, with us Brian Whitman, Deputy Spokesman for the Department of Defense, and Charles Lewis, Washington Bureau Chief for the Hearst Newspapers. And we'll go straight to Tewksbury, Massachusetts, and Kristen's joining us. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Great program. I think while we all agree that embedding is critical, it seems that we're also overlooking the fact that this is war. I mean, I know the one journalist, I think his name was Chris, was mentioning the independent journalist, but doesn't there have to be some sort of guardedness against that which is secure and confidential? I mean, there's got to be an element of protectionism on the state of the government. I guess I can't help but understand that aspect of it.
Well, Charles, I remember during the last Gulf War that reporters like Chris, who avoided the pool system, were criticized in some cases. I think removed from the battlefield if they were caught there. I don't remember quite how it worked. Do you?
Well, I think that the lady from Tewksbury raises a really interesting question that I think we should ask Brian Whitman to address, and that is, what happens to when the reporter with the unit, embedded with the unit, is given confidential information about a future military operation? That person, what happens to that person and that correspondent's ability to function at that point? I think that's the question that would be a good one for Brian to look at.
Before we go to Brian, Kristen, I guess what you're saying is if the reporter gets that information, he or she better sit on it, right?
Well, yes, and well, I guess that is the question, is how do we handle that portion of it? And is it wrong for an independent reporter? I mean, I know we shouldn't be, you know, waving guns around, but if something is considered off limits, I think that should be respected, you know? It's war.
Brian.
Sure. Christian, we share that concern with you, and that's why we developed the guidelines. And I don't know if you heard earlier in the show, though I think that most reporters also understand the need to protect certain information. We acknowledge the fact that putting a reporter in a unit for an extended period of time, that there will be a relationship that develops. And we hope that that professional relationship brings together both the reporter and the commander to a common understanding about what can be reported and when it can be reported and what can't be reported. And we do have techniques available to us when reporters are exposed to sensitive information. We may pre-brief them ahead of time. We may say, look, you're about to hear an operations order for a mission that's going to occur tomorrow. What's important that we protect is A, B, and C here. And so they'll be pre-briefed. And then there may be the occasion where a reporter is inadvertently exposed to sensitive information that, if reported in real time, I mean, we have to acknowledge that we live in an information age where communications is nearly instantaneous. Then we would debrief the reporter and say, look, what you heard, the information E, F, and G, we would like you to hold until this period of time, because we believe that that would put in risk our operation or the people that are doing it.
Brian, my understanding is that the principal conflicts that we're talking about here don't actually come when a reporter has access to battle plans or information which, as you said earlier in the program, might put some soldiers' lives at risk. But the disagreement between journalists and the military comes over those in the vast gray areas where, you know, if there are some casualties, or if there is some friendly fire, or if there are some civilian killed, then the reporters are saying, you know, this is important, I need to get this out. And the commanding officer is saying, we don't want to, you know, let people know that their bombs are reaching our unit. And that seems to me where most of the conflicts will come, no?
Well, I suppose that it could be where some of them come from. The items that you mentioned, like casualties or friendly fire casualties, all those things are reportable items of information. What we want to make sure
Within certain time frames, limits that are laid out by the military. It's not sort of, yeah, you can go ahead and file on that stuff.
Well, we want to make sure of two things. First of all, we've asked news organizations as well as reporters to have some respect for our next of kin notification.
Of course.
And I don't think that there's any real disagreement there, as long as we conduct it in a timely fashion. Nobody wants to learn that their loved one has been killed or injured by a news report or by a television picture. But what we want to make sure that we protect is that type of operational information, not information that necessarily is embarrassing or may not be particularly flattering for the unit that the reporter may be with. The only information that we're interested in protecting is that information that goes to the direct success of the mission or to the safety of those individuals that are conducting the mission.
All right, Kristen, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Raleigh, North Carolina now. Jim's on the line. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
My brother-in-law is a photojournalist, and he's one of the embedded that's in Kuwait right now, and he's up close to a front line. One of your guests had talked about, was a little dismissive before, about the amount of access that they've got.
Right.
Although he won't be up front with somebody with a gun, he's in the range of retaliatory fire. So we're really worried about him when the first wave goes into Kuwait, into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, he's out there with everybody. And the second thing is, he's not from a national newspaper. He's from a local newspaper, and he's with a unit that he's traveled to Afghanistan and Bosnia with before, too. So he's got a hometown perspective that I think is really important. I think most of us want to know what's going on and how it affects us, not necessarily how it affects people, you know, everywhere. And this, I think, is important to hear from somebody who's local.
You're talking about stories about the soldiers. You're not talking about somebody in the battlefield trying to create this great big geopolitical picture, but somebody who's actually reporting on the soldiers.
Yeah, I, when it comes to war, I think everyone's concerned about their family, not about policy.
Charles.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of journalism that I was talking about earlier, that embedded correspondents will be able to produce better than anybody else. They'll know the dynamics of the unit they're with. They'll know the people, and the people will know them. You know, in Desert Storm, traveling press, the embedded press, was almost a morale factor for the troops. The troops saw our presence as a validation of the importance of their mission. They saw us as evidence that the outside world was interested in what they were doing. And I think a lot of commanders used the press as sort of a morale factor for their units, because we were there and it made people feel good about what they were doing. You know, I'd like to just add a little historical perspective to the lady from Tewksbury. This goes back to the Vietnam era, if I could mention a historical reference. And in Vietnam, a correspondent, a camera person, was given a credential. It was called the MACV credential, Military Assistance Command Vietnam. And you signed a statement in return for that credential that said you would not report or broadcast future military operations. You would phrase losses, casualties in certain ways, this sort of things. And then you were given your free rein. With that credential, you could embed with a unit. You could jump on a helicopter if there was space, ride in a jeep with a unit if the commander was agreeable. And as long as you didn't violate those rules, you were given absolutely free access. And I think that we would like to see that kind of pattern, that kind of model emerge from the current embedding program, where free access, as long as you keep in mind the ground rules. During Vietnam, there were very, very few violations of these ground rules. Most of the violations were by freelancers who, you know, did not have a full grasp of what the ground rules required or whatever. And it worked very well from the media's perspective in terms of access, and at the same time not betraying future operations and working within the limitations that the ground rules imposed.
All right, Jim, thanks for that call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston, Marie's joining us. Hi, Marie.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My feeling is it's absolutely essential to have journalists at the site of war. I mean, atrocities occurred in the Kuwaiti war, or Gulf War, I guess it's called. And if it weren't, and Geneva Conventions were broken. And I think that it's terribly important to have we have to sort of keep a certain morality, if there is a morality in this war. We have to know what's going on there on the ground or in the air. Otherwise, as the public, we don't know what's going on.
Marie, let me ask you a question about it in television terms, though, because I suspect in the last 10 years we have become so used to watching live news unfolding on television. I wonder if our expectation of live war on television isn't something that is drawing people towards what they think is going to happen. Do you draw a line there in terms of what should be shown, what should be broadcast, and what should not?
Well, I think a lot is hidden by television. I mean, we saw in the Gulf War bombing from... We didn't see what was going on the ground. We didn't see... people being covered up. We didn't see I can't remember the name, tanks and so forth being run over. We didn't see, what else didn't we see? We didn't see I think that the bombing of troops when they're withdrawing was absolutely appalling. Did we see much of that? No, we didn't really see what was going on and what was going on I just don't think that I'm not sure what your question is, but do we see truth by television? No, I don't think we do. I think we people
we
who...
seem to have lost... Oh, no.
No, here we are, yeah.
Okay, Marie, let me actually take that, if I can, and turn to Charles, because, Charles, do you have a sense of how the coverage of a war in Iraq, assuming it happens, will look in a way that's different from the Gulf War?
Yes, Dick. There's been a communications revolution since Desert Storm, and it's in favor of the media. In Desert Storm, we were captives, at least in the pool system, we were captives of the military's communications system. Now, as you know, a satellite phone is easy to use, it's cheap to buy, it's easy to carry around, and you can use that to uplink video, still photos, stories, this sort of thing. And I think that that's a huge difference between the 1991 war and any war that may ensue in Iraq in 2003. And I think that that may have led somewhat to the rethinking in the Pentagon of how to deal with the media in this new liberal environment. And I think that the Pentagon is trying to make the best of it, of a situation that has moved in favor of the media in the last 12 years, and at the same time, you know, have the military get some policy requirements set down so that you know, their interests are protected and their goals are not jeopardized by this unlimited communications potential. I think the
let me see if I can just get a last word from Brian. Yes. Whitman on this, because Brian, I'm interested in from your perspective as well on how you think the coverage of a war in Iraq in 2003 will differ from earlier war coverage that we've seen and read and heard and listened to.
Yes, you know, there was probably a few dozen reporters that were embedded with U.S. forces on D-Day. If there is a war in Iraq, there will be hundreds of reporters that are embedded with U.S. units. There will be a face to this battle if there is one. And one thing that we haven't talked about that I think is also important, though, it's a recognition of what Charles said, and that is we live in a global information age where communications is instantaneous. And our potential adversary in this conflict is a master of disinformation. He's a practiced liar, Saddam Hussein is. And what better way to counter some of that disinformation than to have a large contingent of reporters that are out there alongside our troops reporting what actually occurs in near real time to the extent that we can without compromising the missions or the safety of the people that are doing them.
Well, as everybody seems to be saying on the program, Brian, we'll wait and see, won't we? Thanks for being with us. Brian Whitman is Deputy Spokesman for the Department of Defense. Charles Lewis, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Dick.
Charles is Washington Bureau Chief for the Hearst Newspapers. Earlier in the program, we talked with NPR's Eric Westervelt, who's currently in Kuwait, and Chris Hedges of the New York Times. Connection listeners, you can continue this conversation online. We're at theconnection.org. We have forum pages there if you'd like to take advantage of those. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon.